all CEOs, me included, we don't actually know what we're doing.
They're all sharks, so all you got to do, though, is know shark bait.
I don't think we've ever talked about this before.
We can capture all of the wallet share.
First place you start is with the product.
That's just the first nut.
This is the Capital Stack.
Hey, everybody. This is David Paul, the host of the Capital Stack podcast, where we talk to founders, operators, and investors about all things value creation in startups. I'm changing up the guest list a little bit today. We are talking about an operator, but we're not talking about startups necessarily. His background actually has been in corporate America, but he is one of the most genuine and wonderful people that I know. And he's got a big boy job, which is the CTO of Ariba Business Networks over at a little company called SAP, and has become a really good friend of mine, Pete Colligan. Pete, how are you?
I'm great. Happy to be here. Life is great. Better with you in it, David. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, we need to go. Have, you know, a really big breakfast together.
Yeah, I like the simple diners. That might be a bit low bar for you, but I'm all about diners.
You like diners and you like chains. You're like an IHOP guy.
Yeah, I like to stay on a budget.
It's the Midwest in you, Pete.
Could be. Yeah. I like to know who's serving me my food. So I get to know names and talk to people and, you know,
exactly.
I grew up watching Cheers, you know, that place where everyone knows your name.
Mm-hmm.
That's an old reference, but I like that kind of ambiance.
Yeah. It's all about trust.
There you go. Oh, I feel we're segueing into something.
We could be segueing, or we could just completely talk about something else. I see you're wearing a puffy vest. Is this like your investor look today?
I'm cold in my office, so okay. I put on a vest today.
Gotcha. Pete, why don't you give the audience a little bit about your background thus far, and then we can talk about some cool stuff.
Yeah. Personally, I grew up in Minnesota. You mentioned the Midwest. That's obviously a big part of my character. Sometimes it comes out in my accent a little bit as well. I grew up in northern Minnesota. I grew up on a farm. Both parents were teachers and coaches, sports. So sports were a big part of my life growing up. It's also where I learned a lot about leadership and committing to things and putting in the work. So a lot of that work ethic also on a farm comes through in a lot of kind of my leadership style here. As I cross over to tech and enterprise SaaS and the corporate world. I've been with SAP since a startup was acquired. It was actually out of Scottsdale called Chymetrics, was acquired in 2004 or 2005-ish time period. And at that time, SAP was getting into industries. And since then, just been a fire starter within SAP. Working on all sorts of complex things and trying to simplify them and make customers happy. I'll stop there.
Okay. Well, what did Chymetrics, I'm pronouncing that right, right?
Chymetrics.
What did they do, and why did SAP want to buy them?
Yeah, Chymetrics did retail analytics. So at that point in time, retailers are really good at storing POS data. And big data warehouses, but they weren't good at understanding that data. So because of kind of my STEM background and math, they needed to do some analysis on that data, a lot of statistics. That's where the chi came from. Chi squared is a statistical term. And that's basically the value proposition of the company, is taking a bunch of that transaction data and using that to forecast future sales. Future inventories, and then, of course, incorporating that into the overall supply chain planning process. So we developed first analytics tooling and support, largely through consulting services, and then built that into a product and then a set of products. And then SAP was getting into the retail space And that was a nice, I think, tuck-in acquisition for them in that space.
So SAP is a giant. You're a guy that was in a startup that was acquired from them. How did you all of a sudden become the innovation guy, right? The guy that was able to start bringing a lot of their older platforms that are kind of on-prem into the cloud. How did they identify you as the guy?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I was identified. I just started building, let's say, getting curious about things, deeply curious about things. And as an engineer, I tend to draw my attention to things that are inefficient and therefore want to make them better. And just started to do some things that I wasn't being told to do them. and people noticed. I also then tried to find people with similar mindset in the company. And then you just kind of, you know, get on repeat and kind of do that. And you get a bigger network of people. That network, the saying, right? It's who you know that determines kind of what you get to work on, and what you get to work on kind of determines what you get to know. So I started to go through kind of that cycle and then build credibility and trust with some leadership, and then eventually got to work on bigger projects. That's kind of how it manifested itself.
Yeah. Initiative. That's something that I think gets lost a lot today.
Something without being told. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of where it started. And largely it was just a passion of mine. I love tech. Computer science lets you go in many different directions. And that was, satisfying for me, still is. My impact is a little different these days than back then.
And so you have been able to work on some amazing projects and projects that required you to, build business units within larger business units, complex stuff, corporate innovation. Tell us a little bit about how you thought about structuring a team for that and bringing them together, launching products, ..
Yeah. I mean, depending on kind of what the goal is kind of determines how you go about set that up. But for the most part, there's kind of a method I go through when I kind of set up things. One of them is to, when you have a team, focus on kind of creating a team and what that means. A lot of that is around having a common vision around what we're trying to do. Not all projects have the same risk profile, so it's important to get people on there that are comfortable with some level of risk. So a lot of the projects I've been on had a lot of uncertainty to them. And you want to make sure, there's the right kind of character in the folks that are working with you as a first step, because not everything's going to be known, and some people thrive in that environment and some not so much, right? So as anything, it starts with the team and kind of getting the right people there. Then you start to get into kind of making sure that your goals are clear, how you're aligning with the ecosystem around it, those different stakeholders. And then structuring your kind of operating model as a team, your rhythm as a team. How are we going to plan? How are we going to prioritize? How do we, let's say, react when things change as a team? And how do we track our progress and momentum so that we surface up our achievements? But at the same time, as team members, it's important when you're in these kind of challenging, more complex environments to show progress and momentum, because that's kind of motivating and kind of feeding back into that team culture, right? That's kind of in a nutshell where I start with. But I always start with team, right? Because that's typically with those projects, it's going to be a grind for a bit, and you got to have some kind of passion. You got to find your why you're doing it. Mm-hmm.
And is that difficult, like having that why, when you're kind of like doing a software reboot or a product reboot? for instance, you know, in your case, and, you know, the directive isn't coming from a founder, but from, you know, a corporate initiative. And I mean, is there like reputational risk for people that are coming into projects that might not work? Like how do y'all think about that?
I'm sure there is. I think, you know, part of that leadership is having a good story. And that's actually really tough in a bigger company because sometimes strategy is a bit diluted. So you really try and crisp that up, and the more, let's say, multidimensional you are as a leader, I think, the better stories you can tell and the more contextual stories you can tell, depending on the audience. Like, it's different when you're talking to a management team, or a leadership team about that story versus how you're talking to, you know, a scrum team or a pod of engineers and product managers and UX folks that are actually building the product. You have to find a way to connect that. And that's probably one of the harder things to do, because, you know, at least as a founder, I think it's something hopefully you deeply believe in, and that story is pretty easy to articulate. And sell. And in a big company, you know, it, like I said, there's a lot of other things going on, and you have to kind of find a way to get people excited about it. Reputational risk. I think, you know, you probably tap a little into what I would frame around change management. And change management, I think, you know, ADKAR is a very familiar framework that we've used, which I think is kind of an acronym for the change management process. But it always starts with why, right? The awareness of why we're doing this. And that helps generate desire, which is the D. Then you want to make sure people have the knowledge, right? Like sometimes, and we're going through some of these things in the company regarding things like DevOps transformation and things, you know, you want to make sure as much as possible that you set the expectations clear on the why, but then you also make, you know, create a path for folks so they feel like they're part of that, like they have a role in this new future. Otherwise, you know, it's you're not going to get the buy-in, and then, you know, you can try and micromanage your way through these things, but it's not effective and it definitely won't scale. So it's important to, you know, regarding the reputational risk, I think find those folks that are these people with a lot of credibility, and their no's are quite empowered if they say no to something, and to really sit with them and have that discussion and be able to have the crucial conversation with them. Like, here's what's going on, right? And here's my perspective. What's your perspective? Can we make this work? How do we move forward here? So that's kind of, you know, I'm spitballing here a little bit, but that's how I would approach it.
Yeah. And so, you know, you have worked within an organization for quite some time, so I'm sure there's people that you can recruit and have recruited, you know, across different platforms. But the new hire, how do you, like, what's your basic framework for hiring, especially within the product and engineering side, knowing that these are big investments? It takes a while to get people productive. You know, it's the equivalent of, you know, almost like a salesperson, right? You know, there's a quota, there's a ramp, and you're either productive or you're not productive. And, making a misstep is very difficult, especially if you're budget constrained.
Yeah. I mean, I think first, you know, for me, it was important for one of my projects. I had to hire like 150 people in 2 years, right? Which is putting a lot of stress on a system that isn't used to that kind of,
say so,
kind of used to it. So the first thing I had to do was find my partners and alliances in that. And it didn't even have to do with, you know, the candidate side. It was really making sure that I had partners in that process, whether it was HR or folks on the compensation side. And then internally talked with my team in terms of what are things that are important for us in hiring, right? And there's obviously a technical component, but building software is such a team sport. And especially building software that's new, you know, where things are undefined, like I said. So what are the certain things that we're going to be looking for? So being intentional, I think, is the first step about what you're trying to do and what kind of culture you have. And that's determined a lot by the product you're trying to build, the maturity of that product, and the type of product, right? So I started there. And then, of course, you know, that starts with writing the job description, being clear on kind of how you want to set up teams. Of course, that's a whole other discussion, how you want to set up teams. But you want to make sure that you get the right people applying to the position first, because, you know, if you do the math on the time it takes to interview folks, you want to make sure that you're being efficient with that. So by the time it gets, you know, to me, for instance, and I made sure I was a part of every hire interview, at least, even if it was like 15 minutes, that was important to me. Also so I could get feedback on the interview process itself. So we could improve, that initial step of funneling, right? Just like you would in a kind of sales process, right? Where you'd want to funnel it to a point where by the time it comes to like a face-to-face or Zoom type of interview, that things were already pretty well matched, right? Then you can focus a little bit on those kind of more critical things, situational type questions. You know, they call them cultural interviews sometimes, but these are really kind of situational aspects that help illustrate how somebody behaves in a certain situation, what's important to them in their day-to-day work. So you can use that to make sure both sides are a good fit. So we were really intentional about that. And then as we worked through it a couple of times, then just because of the doing this at scale, when I mentioned how many people we were hiring, then we started to look at places like, how could we automate this a little bit? How could we put some efficiencies into that process? And then the big key step after that was the onboarding, right? So what is their first 4 weeks going to look like coming in, and how do we capitalize on that hire and take that, hopefully what was a positive interview experience, into the team so that they're, you know, it doesn't feel like, hey, it was a kind of bait and switch in the interview process, and now they come in and, you know, basically there's no support there. So it's really modeled. We model it as an end-to-end process terms of how we hired.
Yeah. I think that's a process that is at least the transition from hire to onboard, like that's somewhere that startups really fall short of. And knowing that it's hard, you can't do everything right from a resource constraint and everything's, you know, on fire. But I think setting up structure in and around onboarding right after, like, okay, you hired them, now what? Right. You know, like you throw them into a chair, like that's, like, what is the next step? How do they familiarize themselves with that? And I think that,
yeah, and it's not that the hire and the offer is not the outcome to me, right? So we sat down and we said, what is really the outcome here? And the outcome is, you know, what's the best case scenario where somebody who doesn't even know about us but has some interest in what we're doing and something to bring to that, how long does that take before they have the great experience of feeling like they're productive in the team. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's where onboarding became part of that outcome, and process. And then that didn't exist. So that in itself to me was also an innovation that we had to bring in order to do that.
So, I mean, I understand the importance of hiring great people, but probably because I haven't done a lot of hiring, and the hiring that I have done hasn't always been great, because I'm just not very experienced with it. So Pete, in your mind today, in the world of technology, in the world of team building within technology, we've kind of been in this little tech recession for the last couple of years, I should say. Some people are feeling it, some people aren't feeling it. What areas have got you concerned, and what areas get you excited?
In the context of technology?
Yeah, technology and team building within technology.
One area that I'm excited about and we're actually working with teams is around using some modern tools that incorporate, you know, some of these new breakthroughs in large language models around coding productivity, and seeing a lot of benefits with that, especially for some of our, let's say some of our more common type of software design patterns and or repetitive type things. There's a lot of automation. You know, there's always been coding assist in some of these tools for some time, but it's kind of gotten next level, and that's also gotten, you know, engineers quite excited as well, because, you know, that innovation, which has also got a lot of buzz more on customer facing scenarios like service and support and things like that. They're also starting to see some of that hit some of their tooling and around developer productivity and developer experience. So that's one area I'm definitely interested in, and we're piloting some things with our teams. There's a lot going on. There's also some things around the modern data stack, which is quite interesting to me. You know, that market, there's, you know, with things like, you know, Snowflake and the ecosystem of companies where things are more self-service, similar what happened to kind of the data science topics, where it became easier to do things, and they came out and said, you know, there's this thing called citizen data scientists now, which just meant that analysts could kind of cross over a little bit into some of the more sophisticated type of things, just because the tools and layers of abstraction got more and more. We're starting to see that in the data stack as well. And that's definitely something I'm interested in as well. In terms of team building, that's one where obviously everyone's in this kind of swirl at the moment, post COVID, you know, trying to figure out what that means, and in terms of return to office and how that impacts, you know, team dynamics and things like that. And we're actually doing some interesting stuff with UCI and some research there, where we try and kind of give our experience from what we're seeing and cross-reference that with some academic work that's going on with companies like Microsoft. So those are some things that are kind of coming to the top of my mind that is kind of exciting. So anyone that's kind of looking to get, you know, into something, you know, let's say things have cooled off and kind of looking now, you know, where things are moving, those are definitely some areas where I think it's good to kind of study up on what's going on there, because that's, I definitely see those things not going away in the near term.
What is the data stack? There's warehouses, and then there's ingestion. What else sits in that? Categorically.
Yeah, categorically. I mean, you know, there's definitely a layer where it comes about just, you know, basically collecting all types of data. And that's been around for a while, but it's become, I think, some of the toil around getting that data, just connecting the different sources of data. Now there's like curated data sets out there that are kind of easier to plug into from an API perspective. The infrastructure is a bit more managed, so you don't need, let's say, an infrastructure team to kind of set that up for you. You can kind of get more off-the-shelf software to help you do that and kind of get it into an initial landing zone. That's kind of one capability of that data stack. Then, of course, you know, that data in its raw format can be used to serve many different workloads in terms of analytics and AI. And in enterprise, there's things around master data, which becomes important when you have a portfolio of products and you're trying to integrate them together. So you have, let's say, different, beyond just the extraction and loading of the data, there's you know, tools now that are much easier to configure for transforming that data into and shaping it into a more useful context. And then from there, whether it's, you know, analytics that you're embedding in your SaaS application, or more of like a data warehouse type of situation where you're bringing, you know, your company data, but also external data, and slicing and dicing that data, you know, those tools have definitely hit the SaaS type of experience, and have become closer to our consumer grade experience. So I think the, a lot of the consumer apps, you know, initially influenced a lot what we expect out of SaaS apps. And then that trickled over into enterprise. I think that's now starting to trickle over into some of these data products, as they're called. And they're also becoming a lot more, let's say, easier to collaborate on different things. I saw this week, you know, or read up on, Salesforce coming out with what they call Data Cloud. Microsoft has something called Dataverse. These are kind of things that show, you know, the enterprise is kind of starting to adopt and embrace some of these technologies and innovations that have been happening in some of these, let's say, growth companies that have focused on simplifying storage, you know, access and consumption of different data loads and workloads, right? Whether it's AI or analytics or these sorts of things. So typically, I think the term now is the modern data stack. Like if you were to Google it, there's a lot of discussion about it. But I think it's quite disruptive to some of those existing incumbents in that space who kind of, when you went down that path, you know, you were really stuck in an appliance and basically, you know, it's fine. You can do a lot, but it's the appliance. It's the big monolithic data stack. And now there's more options and it's easier to get those options playing well together in a sandbox.
So you've been in this business for a couple of decades, and I'm sure that you've seen iterations of platforms being kind of the enterprise's go-to preference versus best in class. Where do you think we're headed now?
Boy, that's that's a tough one. I think it's easy. It always looks good to say your product is a platform, but I think the problem is sometimes you miss what problem are you solving first that you need a platform to scale, right? So for certain, let's say, companies, to bet too much on a platform early, I think is a mistake. I think it's about finding your wedge, finding the problem that you're solving, and then expanding based on different types of capabilities you decide to offer later on. You know, to come out and say, I'm building a platform, you know, unless you're kind of really marketing to developer ecosystem, you know, I think that's tough to lead with, because, you know, you're basically selling a toolbox of things. So at some point it does become important as a company to think about platform, because you'll start to get benefits of economies of scale and scope, right? Like, you know, now if I expand into a customer and they needed another capability, it's very easy to turn that on if I'm running more in a platform type of environment versus having to go through like a new implementation phase with a customer. And then if you obviously a platform, just from a cost perspective, if you're able to share resources between different apps, that's going to help you on your gross margins, right? As well. So, you know, typical architect answer, right? It depends.
Right.
I think is the answer.
Right.
But yeah, generally in my experience, it's tough to lead with platforms.
It is definitely tough to lead with platforms, you know, especially in early stage you know, because your just stuff is not going to be good, right? Like, you're not going to hit all the domains that your customer wants to the depth that they already have, despite it might being a legacy platform. Customers hate it. If I have a dollar for every time I've heard that, it doesn't matter, right? It's just, it's still very, very difficult. But, you know, it's interesting. I was talking to a growth equity guy earlier this week, and he told me that it's just very difficult to, point solutions are like, that's, I don't know, for that term, you know, it just sounds like it's a minimizing term for companies that are focusing on a specific set of capabilities as a point solution. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he said something interesting. He said, you know, what gives a company the right to offer the next, you know, version of capabilities? Is it the platform or is it a new incumbent? And, you know, I think, you know, if you look at it, it really should be the platform first, if they do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you, yeah, start with the customer, work backwards, right? So what's your customer pain points? You know, is a platform going to solve that for them? Is that what they're looking for? Then yes, then maybe you have to build something. I would agree. They might not be looking for a platform. Even they say they're looking for a platform. They might just be looking for, you know, something that's bridging two point solutions that they have today, which sit on the same platform. But in reality, you could solve it with your application, right?
Right.
And that comes with a better value proposition. It also maybe comes with a better price profile. You're faster to innovation, which is important to them. So it really depends. I don't know. I think it's... And in my life, I don't do well with black and white answers.
Right.
Everything's in the gray.
Everything's in the gray. Ain't that the truth? So when we wrap up, Pete, what are some of the most influential leadership books and resources, things that you read today to keep you sharp and master of your craft?
There's one strategy book I look at a lot just because there's so many good things in it. And it's called Good Strategy, Bad Strategy. And I gotta look up my author here. I think it's, Rums. Richard Rohmelt. Yeah. So a lot of times a lot of times people interpret strategy as a wish list of things, right? And good strategy, what I've seen, and also in my experience, which I think Richard outlines pretty well in his book, is about, you know, the hard thing about hard things, making choices and being clear about where you are, right? And I think, you know, as you get into a bigger company, it becomes harder and harder to figure out what's really going on. But it becomes so crucial because everything falls from that. And you need to know kind of what to say no to if you're really looking for driving outcomes, right? So that's, you know, part of leadership is making choices, making the tough choices. And as you go up the chain, the choices become a lot more difficult and I would even speculate harder to reverse, at least at the same company. So that is one book that I would say. I don't read leadership books. What I like to read is people, because I think I'm a big believer that leadership surfaces and is demonstrated by situations. So you can prepare yourself for leadership, but at this point, I like to see how different leaders reacted in different situations. A common friend of a mutual friend of ours, David, recommended a book that I read called The Kill Chain by Christian Brose. I'm reading that one right now. And it's written by Christian was chief of strategy for John McCain. And when John McCain was running basically, you know, kind of our entire defense, you know, strategy and budgets and things like that. And they were confronted with real hard strategic questions. And even if they had the answers to some things, you know, it comes down to how do you actually build a bridge to get those things done. And obviously, you know, in government and in most governments these days, you know, that becomes a very hard thing to do. So I'm very interested in how people find that common ground and build bridges, as I think that's, you know, one of the key things, especially as I've grown into my career. That's one of the things is how do you build bridges to get things done? And how do you convince people that they should do it when there's a million other things that they could be doing?
Yeah. No, I agree. Well, Pete, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate it. And I'm gonna come up and see you soon.
Do it. Anytime. You don't need a reservation.
Do it. Everybody, thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Capital Stack. If you like it, please subscribe, tell a friend, hit the like button, and do me a big favor, give me a review, because it helps with whatever the hell this thing, these platforms want. I guess algorithm gives me better algo credit. And I will see everybody next week. We drop an episode every Tuesday. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to the Capital Stack Podcast. Make sure to share this with someone you know that can benefit from this content. Remember to support this show by rating, reviewing, and subscribing. David Paul is the founder and general partner at DWP Capital. All opinions expressed by David and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of DWP Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. David and guests may maintain positions in the securities discussed on this podcast.